And our program for this Tuesday is very fun. It will be opened by Professor Laurie Davis of the University of in Essen, and he will speak about breakdown and loops.
So, thank you very much. I'd like to thank the organisers for inviting me. As you can already see, this is joint work with Ursula Garter of the University of Dortmund. And we'll start off with a very simple situation, one that everybody knows. You've got a data set X1 to XN, and you're looking for some sort of location summary. Then one thing that's very popular in robust statistics is to take the median, and the finite sample breakdown point of the median is known to be around about a half. if you're looking at a scale summary, and we look at the median absolute deviation, that if you ask somebody what's the breakdown point of the MAD, they'll tell you it's a half. Well, that's not strictly speaking true. If we look at this data set here, then the breakdown point of the median absolute deviation for this data set is actually 1/7. The reason is that we've got three observations which are identical there, so we've just got to move a fourth one to the value of 0.73. We have four observations at 0.73, and the MAD is zero. And that is usually classified as a breakdown on scale. The third situation is completely different. We now have 3, 6, 9 observations, and they give the number of successes in trials. So you have trials, each trial is of length 7, and you give the number of successes. So you can think of a sort of binomial 7p model, and you're trying to give some sort of summary of the probability p. Well, there's one simple way of doing it, which is to restrict all the x's to values between 0 and 7, and to define breakdown as going to the border of the parameter space. And if you do this, the border of the parameter space is 0 and 1. And in order to get your estimate going to that, either 0 or 1, you've got to move all 7 observations. Yeah? So your breakdown point is 1. Yeah? So what we're trying to do in this paper is to give a sort of explanation for these sort of things. I'll start off giving you a general definition of breakdown, which probably you all know in any case. We then bring in the groups and talk about equivariance in section 2. We have one theorem, which is in section 3. We have some examples in 4. And I'll start criticizing everything in 5 and 6. Okay?
In 6 it breaks down.
That is very... Have you seen my last slide? Yes. That's very close to my last slide. So we'll start off. We're doing, to bring out the structure, we're doing all this in terms of groups, yeah? Which makes the thing look very high-powered, but in fact, it's not. It's really not at all. Huh? You don't need any group theory for doing this. But we start off with a space, just a sample space. We have a set of probability measures on the space, P. We have a parameter space, theta. We have some statistical function, which in the previous examples, for example, the median or the MAD, which measure for each probability measure P gives you a value in your space, a parameter space, theta. We have a metric or a semi-metric on the space of probability measures, which is normalized such that the maximum distance apart of any two probability measures is 1. And we have a metric on the parameter space, which is such that the maximum distance apart is infinite. And again, to fix ideas, you can take the real line. You can look at all distributions, all non-degenerate distributions. The point masses are excluded. Yeah? All non-degenerate distributions. Theta is the positive numbers, excluding 0 and infinity. Your breakdown, your functional could be MAD. The measure you're using on the set of probability measures, I'm using the Kuiper metric, which is very similar to the Kolmogorov one, which people tend to know, but this one takes the maximum over all finite intervals, and not just intervals from minus infinity to x. And the measure we use for distance between two parameter values is the modulus of log of theta 1 minus theta 2. Okay? So that's far so good. And the definition breakdown point I give here is the usual one. It's the smallest what does it depend on? It depends on your functional. It depends on the probability measure where you calculated it. This is often not given explicitly in the literature. People tend to forget that actually breakdown point is a local concept. It breaks down at a particular distribution. And it depends on the two metrics, d, small d and capital D, which we have there. And apart from that, that's just the usual definition of breakdown point, which people tend to use. We're doing this in terms of measures, in terms of metrics, but we haven't done it yet, but we suspect everything will go through if you look at things like finite sample breakdown points. So, one simple example is just to choose a functional t0 such that t0 for p is equal to theta0 for all p. So you just estimate 0 if you're doing location, just estimate 1 if you're doing scale, and that has a wonderful property of having a breakdown point of 1, because nothing ever happens. And the way to get out of this, to having a breakdown point of 1, is to impose some sort of equivariance structure on these objects, on the functional that you're using. So this is what it's going to look like. On the left-hand side, we've got the parameters, we've got the sample space, we've got a group G and a metric, and we've got a functional which is mapping the sample space, the space of probability measures here, into theta. And on the right-hand side, we've got another group HG and another semi-metric D. So I'll go through it again more slowly. We have a group G of transformations which transform your sample space into itself. Yeah? And given a probability measure P, each G induces a probability of PG in the usual manner. We require that the metric, small d, is invariant with respect to the G, so that the distance between PG and QG is the same as the distance between P and Q. And we also have which is possibly a technical condition, but it's virtually fulfilled by all the metrics you've ever heard of, which is this one here, the distance, if you take a convex combination, alpha plus 1 minus alpha Q1 and alpha P plus 1 minus alpha Q2, then they're at most 1 minus alpha apart. So the that's the setup we have on the left-hand side. We have a corresponding setup on the right-hand side. We have another group of transformations which transform the parameter space into itself. And the functional T is equivariant with respect to these two groups. If T of P of G is equal to HG of T of P, that's the equivariance structure that people impose on functionals. We also have invariance properties here. The distance between HG theta 1 and HG theta 2 is the same as between theta 1 and theta 2. And another a similar sort of one below. And I'll make that all, do it all again on the simple example we've got on the MAD. So, the sample space is the real line. The metric on the set of probability measures is the Kuiper metric. The metric on the parameter space is the one we've already had. We're looking at the affine group of transformations. So G is the affine group. So it takes a point X into a point AX plus B with A non-equal to 0. Yeah? And that's the group G. And the group HG operates on the parameter space. And given the G of AX plus B, the HG of theta multiplies theta by the modulus of A. That's the usual sort of affine, the usual equivariance structure you have for scale functionals, okay? And if you look at this carefully, you'll see that all the things we had before are fulfilled. If you look at the definition of the Kuiper metric, then the distance between PG and QG is the same as between P and Q. The distance between HG theta 1 and HG theta 2 is the same as between theta 1 and theta 2. We've done the third one just to show you how simple it all is. the distance between theta 1h to theta 2. Theta 1 is the log of theta 1 divided by mod theta mod a theta 1. The theta 1s cancels out. You just have a log a, and it's the same as the theta 2. So these properties that I mentioned hold. So now we need some more notation for the theorem. GB is the restriction of G, a member of the group, to the set B and B. Iota is the unit element of G. And G0, those are the points, those elements in the group, such that distance between theta and HG of theta is zero. So effectively, for the group transformation, they don't alter the distance between theta and HG of theta. And delta P is the maximum of probability of P of all sets B, which have the following property, that there is some G not in G0, such that G restricted to B is the identity. This may look a bit strange to start off with. You think, what's he talking about? But we'll see what I'm talking about in a moment, because we'll do it again with the MAD. Well, G restricted, that's pretty obvious. The identity is simply Gx is equal to X. G0, those are the transformations which use the scaling variant. If you look at our definition of the scale, then it means that the modulus of A is equal to 1. So this is a transformation which, in a sense, leaves the scale as it was previously. This is the G0s. Those are all the transformations in the group that leave the scale unchanged. So, and if we look now at take a set B, and for some G in G0, B has got to be invariant. So AX plus B has got to be equal to X. And you just invert that, and X has got to be B divided by 1 minus A. And that's allowed because the modulus of A is not 1. So we can divide by 1 minus A. And that's just a single point. So the delta P is actually largest probability, largest mass at a single point. So it's the largest value of an atom of P. Okay? So this delta P reduces, in this particular case, to the largest atom of the probability measure. So, now our theorem is this, that if you iterate your theta, HGN, keep on iterating it, for some G not in G0, take the minimum overall theta and let n go to infinity, then distance between these two things goes off to infinity. And under these conditions, the maximum breakdown point is 1 minus delta P divided by 2. Okay? So that's the one and only theorem, I think. And again, if we look at the MAD, we have to check this one condition here. Well, the distance between theta and HGN of theta, that's theta log theta divided by HGN of theta. HGN multiplies it by mod A, so it's mod A to the N. The thetas cancel, and because we're not in G0, our mod A is not equal to 1, so it's either less than 1 or bigger than 1, so the modulus of the log goes off to infinity. And this means that the breakdown point of any affine equivariant scale functional in R is 1 minus the largest atom divided by 2. And this is a result that's in a 1993 paper of mine. Okay? So that gives you this bound. And it's identical. Question is, can you actually... what's gone wrong? No, that's right. That's the bound. Yeah. So how do we prove it? Well, the idea of the proof is very simple. It's similar to the ones you know if you've done these things for the affine group. It's not very much different. We've got the set B, which is invariant under G, so applying G to it just leaves this set B here, where it is. We have a few points to the left, a few points to the right, so I take, of a block of 4 points to the left, I move 2 nearer to B, and for the one block to the right, I move 1 nearer to B, and that's X star, X sharp is 2 points moved out to the right, another point moved out to the right. And if you look in terms of finite sample breakdown points, you see that X star and X sharp both differ from the original sample by having 3 points moved from them. But they're also related by the group structure here, these 2 points. And if I iterate this, then these 2 X star and X sharp are going to move out of, are going to move a long way from each other, and the thing's going to break down. So that's basically the idea of the proof. So, our theorem only gives you upper bounds. It says the breakdown point is 1 minus delta divided by 2. So the question is this attainable? Well, that answer's quite simple. You know? Even in the simple case of MAD, how do I get an MAD which actually attains this breakdown point? Well, suppose you just take the MAD as it is. It's the median of whatever it is, and you look at the finite sample breakdown of point of that, and it's a maximum of a half and 1 minus delta xn, where delta is, again, the largest atom. Yeah? And as I say, this means, in particular, if the largest atom is bigger than a half, then your MAD is going to be zero and is broken down without doing anything, so it's a breakdown point of zero. Yeah? But in any case, irrespective of that, it's always, in general, going to be less than this upper bound. Yeah, which is 1 minus delta divided by 2. So can you get the upper bound in this sort of situation? Well, one attempted improvement is not to take... If we go back and look at the definition of the MAD, we're taking the median of the absolute deviations from the median. But instead of taking the median of the absolute deviations, we'll take a quantile, another quantile. And the other quantile is 1 plus alpha over 2. So we'll take the 1 plus alpha over 2 quantile. So if alpha is equal to 0, we reduce this to the MAD. So the notation is not very good there. A median, absolute deviation, but it's not a median. It's a 1 plus alpha divided by 2 quantile. Now, you go through the calculations for the finite sample breakdown point of this, and it turns out to be that, which is this approximate expression given on the third line. And now, if just by luck... the delta xn is equal to the alpha you choose, you'll find that the finite sample breakdown point of the MAD is indeed 1 minus delta xn over 2. So I've attained it. But of course I'm cheating, because my calculation of the finite sample breakdown points does not assume that the alpha depends on the x's, on the space, on the delta. This choice of alpha depends on delta xn. Whereas the calculation of the breakdown point before, it was fixed. Once and for all, did not depend on the sample space. So if you go through the calculation and see whether you've actually attained it or not, and the answer is no, you haven't. You get a 1 minus delta divided by 3. And again, this is a result in my 1993 paper on similar sorts of things. So what do you do? Well, you can actually do it. You've got to alter it again. So you take the largest atom of points in the interval, median minus MAD alpha, to that, and choose the smallest alpha such that alpha is bigger than this delta alpha. So you don't take the largest atom, you take the largest atom in the interval you're covering. Yeah? And then you take this alpha star, and then, unless I've made some mistake somewhere, you actually do now get a 1 minus delta divided by 2. Okay, so it is attainable. Yeah? We can take some more examples. here we have the... scatter functionals on the affine group on k-dimensional Euclidean space. So we have all the theta is a set of all positive definite symmetric matrices. G is the affine group. Hg, well, if you're given a G, A, X plus A, then Hg of sigma pre-multiplies by A and post-multiplies by A transpose. And the distance between two between sigma 1 and sigma 2 is defined as the modulus of the log of delta of sigma 1 times sigma 2 to the minus 1, which is a sort of one thing that one can use there. So what is G0? Well, if you go through the motions of what G0, those are going to be all affine transformations with determinant equal to 1, because they don't alter your shape. And you look at your delta P, what are my P's? What are the transformations? What are the subsets of the space which are being left invariant in the transformation? These are hyperplanes now of dimension less or equal to k minus 1. So your delta P is the largest amount of mass put on a hyperplane of a low dimensional hyperplane. And so you'll get the result that the maximum breakdown point is 1 minus delta P divided by 2. Okay? And again, this is a theorem... 3.2 of the Annals paper in 1993. You're going to say, well, is it attainable? Well, I suspect it is, but as I say, this is work in progress. We haven't actually gone down and done the same for the MADs. We have done for this, but presumably by altering some things like Peter Rozier's minimum volume ellipsoid or something like that, you can actually get these things to have the breakdown point of 1 minus delta P over 2 globally. Location, we can do that as well. Location in k-dimensional Euclidean space, you just shift something to the right. You know? And again, you go through the motions. In this particular case, if you shift a set to the right, of course, it doesn't remain invariant. You know? So you've no sets B and B0. So B0 is the empty set, so delta of P is going to be 0. So you get the usual result of the finite sample breakdown point. Or the breakdown point here is a half, at most a half. Yeah. And we can also do the regression case. So if you alter your... if you take the G's, the set transformation is taking... which is effectively a translation group again. And you go through the motions once again, checking what is your B's and one thing or another, your B0's, and what leaves what invariant. Then again, you end up with a hyperplane, so lower dimensional K-1. And so you'll get a finite sample, or a breakdown point. These are not finite samples. These are measured in terms of metrics. You've got a breakdown point of 1 minus delta P divided by 2. Yeah. And again, we suspect, though we haven't gone through the motions, that will be attainable. Yeah. Well, let's go back to, in terms of this, looking at it in terms of this sort of general way, let's go back to the binomial case. And you then start thinking, well, what's X? Well, okay, presumably you allow everything to be, even though you're looking at counting, somebody could have put a decimal point in by mistake or whatever. Theta is 0, 1, should be actually in round brackets there, excluding 0 and 1. I don't know whether I have to exclude 0 or 1. Do I have to exclude? It doesn't really matter. Anyway. The group G, the only group you can think of here, is the identity. I mean, what groups leave this problem, in a sense, invariant? Right? And the only thing we can think of is simply the identity. Yeah? And so in this sort of situation, your G0 is going to be empty, your delta P is going to be 0. The distance between, because HG is the identity, or all these things no longer hold that we had in our theorem. So in a sense, it's not surprising that you're going to get a finite sample breakdown point of 1. Yeah? So except there's no group structure there, which is going to reduce your finite sample breakdown point to something below 1. You can, in a sense, think of it like this. You've got a mass of data, and at some point in the data, you've got a small, very, very highly structured subset of your data. Well, if it's a very highly subset of your data, you can find it, even though there's a lot of noise going on. But if it's very highly structured, it's going to have a very small group of invariant transformations. Yeah? So having a large group of invariant transformations effectively means there's not very much structure there. Yeah? So let's have a look at... to some extent, this is arbitrary. We looked at the location case, but if you look very carefully, I only looked at transformations of location case, which are functions of location case, which are translation equivalent. Whereas mostly, you also even in the location case, you will require them to be affine equivariant, AX plus B. And this one condition we had at the very start of our theorem. The limit infimum of something, something's got to be equal to infinity, does not hold in this situation. That does not hold. Yeah? And the result is, you're not going to get a finite sample breakdown point of a half in this particular case. Yeah? And the question is, can you even get a half? As far as we know, this problem is still open. You know, whether you can get an affine equivariant location thing, which has a finite sample breakdown point of a half in higher dimensions. Yeah? You can, to some extent, do it if you take we've done it now for a finite sample breakdown points, not in terms of metrics. Yeah? And we can actually find a function which will give you a finite sample breakdown point of a half at a particular point. Not globally, but at a particular point. And to do this, the proof we've got is a little bit odd. You look at the orbits, you take any metric, any point P, you look at the orbits of it, and for two... for two measures, P and Q, the orbits are either disjoint or they're the same. So once you pick a point in the orbit, you can define that in any manner what you like whatsoever, as long as you do the remainder of the points in the orbit using the transformation. So you can choose one point in the orbit, define that in any manner you want, and the rest of the orbit is then defined by the transformation. Which means on disjoint orbits, you have a lot of choice. And by using this choice, you can actually get a finite sample breakdown point of a half at some points. On the other hand, it's quite easy to see there are situations in here where you can't get a half for affine equivariant translation functionals. This is one here. Any affine, there's a mass of a third at each of these 3 points. Any affine equivariant locational function must give you the point 1 divided by root 3 and 0. And if you replace the x3, which is root 3 by eta times root 3, then the function has got to give you eta divided by root 3, and as you let eta go off to infinity, it's going to break down. So you're breaking down here at a third. So it's got a finite sample, breakdown point here of a third. Yeah? And in high dimension, it's going to be 1 over k plus 1. Yeah? Now, there are some high degree of arbitrariness in all this. I mean, you saw the trouble I have when I get to the binomial case. I said, well, the only group I can think of is the identity. But maybe somebody's got another one. Yeah? So it's not quite clear what groups you take. It's not even quite clear what sort of probability measures you're going to allow. Yeah? Are you going to take all of them? For instance, if you're doing time series, do you take all probability measures on R to infinity? Or do you take only those which are themselves stationary or whatever? Group, you know, as I say, there are no canonical Gs. Maybe you've forgotten a group or something like this. It's not quite clear. Even the choice of D, I started off right at the beginning taking the Kuiper metric. And some of you may have wondered, why did he take the Kuiper metric? Well, if you look in Huber's book, you see if you take the Kolmogorov metric, you give a scale breakdown point of a quarter. Yeah? So getting a half is, in a sense, it's not quite clear why some metrics give you a half and other metrics give you something else. Yeah? We have a choice of HG, choice of equivariance, and a choice of a metric. And one would like these things to be somehow canonical, that you know, there's a way of doing the right thing. But at the moment, everything seems to be somewhat arbitrary. If you take other more complicated models, say graphical models, one graphical model could be that x1 and x2 are conditionally independent given x3 and x4. What are the group of transformations here which leave this thing invariant? I've no real idea. Yeah? Time series models, I mean, what leaves an autoregressive process of order 1 invariant? The only thing you can think of, if you're doing it on the big space, are the lags, taking lags and multiplying by a non-zero number. Yeah? And those are the only groups of transformations I can think of that leave this problem invariant. Yeah? We think we can get rid of the arbitrariness of the metric on the parameter space by reducing it to the metric on the probability space. So if you have two points on probability space, P theta 1 and P theta 2, then you can define a metric between theta 1 and theta 2. It's a little bit more complicated than that because of the situation we're in, but we think we can do this. And if you do it, for example, for normal distribution, then you can get metrics which behave like the sort of metrics you usually have. It's approximately normal theta 1 minus theta 2. But it has the advantage in this particular case of reducing the degree of arbitrariness in the problem. Yeah? And I call this sort of gossamer connections. That means that all these things are connected, but the connections can be very easily destroyed. It doesn't take very much for all these structures that I've got to suddenly disappear. Yeah? As you've seen, if you take the case of translation, and you allow a functional to be affine equivariant instead of just translational equivariant, then all of a sudden things get more complicated. You don't get the same expression and to become more difficult. Yeah? And so the conclusion, and Stefan Morgenthaler was almost right, yeah? The conclusion of all this is that if you're going to get some non-trivial maximum breakdown point, it seems to depend very delicately on a structure which you have given there, an equivariant structure. And as soon as this structure is in some way tampered with, in any way whatsoever, then you may be in a situation that the whole thing breaks down on you. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
I always had a question, and you're sort of answering at the end. Where does IID come from the permutation? Are you just sort of general enough that really isn't one realization?
No, we're taking empirical measures. Effectively, we're dealing with empirical measures. And if you want to get into a... So the empirical measure would just be a sum of your observations of the point masses, so there'll be no sort of... But it's a good question, because we mentioned that with the autoregressive processes series, then we have to take measures in RZ. Yeah? And then you'd have to look at to get the sort of the dependence between individual observations. Yeah? And it's that we're trying to work out what happens in that situation, but we've not got that far.
I was wondering if you sort of picture you're taking observations out of the group. You can picture filling them back in by some sort of interpolation scheme, so you sort of keep with the realization of a time series.
Well, we can talk about it. I've got some ideas about what to do with time series, but they're not sort of, they were not such that I really felt like doing a transparency for it. But we're thinking about time. Time series is one of the things you'd like to incorporate into such a theory, because there seems to be no reasonable definition of a breakdown point in time series analysis. And we suspect the reason for this is that your group of transformations in time series analysis is so small that it's not going to let you do it.
But see, I was trying to take something out. You put an interpolation back in there, so the group would remain.
Well, it depends how big the group is. If the group's too small, you won't be able to do it. But, yeah.
Okay, one more question, maybe.
So, we've got a lot of arbitrary machinery here. Suppose, let's look at the binomial case. Suppose you look at transformations which consist of multiplication by an integer, so that you get something that, again, somewhat looks like binomial. That's, of course, not a group of transformations. It's only, a semigroup. Can you do all this for transformations which, sets of transformations which form only a semigroup?
Does
that tell you anything about the breakdown?
I doubt it. The thing is, the first sentence, I think, of the conclusion, which I didn't actually mention, we were actually surprised you can prove anything at all in this situation. And somehow the things just and so hang together sufficiently well for you to be able to get a theorem out of it. But our feeling is that if you tamper with it in any way whatsoever, then it's going to collapse on you. Not quite, but it's going to become much more difficult, perhaps like in the translation, affine translations. But if you only have a semigroup there, things could be different. I mean, I don't think your example of multiplying by an integer is actually a good example, because that would not leave our problem invariant. And if you've got a binomial results from a binomial, binomial 7, and you multiply them by 2, then it doesn't look like a binomial 14, because...
Underlying probability. Because you're trying to estimate p, multiplying all the numbers by 2, and you use the sort of standard maximum likelihood, and you get the same estimate. So it's actually invariant under multiplying all the numbers by 2 or by or 100.
We're looking at groups of transformations or probability measures. So you'd have to multiply the binomial 7p by 2, and what does that give you? But anyway, okay.
Yes. I was just going to ask if your difficulty in finding appropriate transformation groups in the binomial case is at all related to the rather arbitrariness in the choice of a link function in most statistical models built on the binomial distribution.
I think if you get link functions and things like that, the thing is, you're going to start as soon as you move away from the affine groups, from location scale and to other things, you tend to get a structure, a much tighter structure, which is being imposed by your probability models. And even sort of looking at other models like binomial or link functions, this imposes a much tighter structure. And so, if you're given a very if the data you're looking at is somehow very highly structured, then you can find this structure probably in a lot of noise. You had an example, almost, in your talk yesterday. Yeah? with a high something that's highly structured, with a lot of noise. And in fact, in the old case, you can make it break down because you can produce the same structure somewhere else, and then you don't know which one to take. But if it's very highly structured, you can't even do this. Yeah? And then you can zoom down onto it in a lot of noise, which will give you a breakdown point of one. And somehow or other, we have the feeling that a large group of transformations leaving the problem invariant means there's not very much structure. The more structure, the smaller the group, and the smaller the group, the higher the breakdown point.
You want to remark the question?
For the binomial, you should try the group C2. I mean, you could take one mapping, which is the identity, and the other, which maps x to n minus x and theta to 1 minus theta. Does that help? Mm-hmm.
Well, we can think about it. I suspect it won't, because here you've got a... There'll be something in the... If you go through the motions of what we have in the theorem, there'll be something that's going to break down, because in the end result, there are things with finite sample breakdown points of 1 for the binomial distribution. Yeah. So I suspect the group is, again, you may be able to find another group, or... And I think you're probably right. Yes, that would be something you can look at. But nevertheless, it wouldn't be big enough to get you away from one.
But couldn't you formulate the theorem a little bit differently if you have a highly structured problem and you have a large group that goes with it naturally? Then for many metrics, the breakdown is the same. Is that true?
I don't know. It's always... I'm not even shedding whether anybody's got a good explanation. If you know... What's the difference between taking the Kolmogorov metric and the Kuiper metric in the scale case? Mm-hmm. The difference is the breakdown point of a half and a quarter. But is there... And obviously you can see that if you just do the calculations, you see it. But is that a general... Is there some general principle here which allows you to define those metrics which are going to give you a half and are not going to give you a quarter?
That's my question.
Yeah. That's one problem we're still thinking of looking at.
Okay, further remarks? Okay, thank you again.